It is Monday, May 22nd, 2006. My name is Sandy Fahler, and I am from the UW-Madison Oral History Project. Today, I am interviewing Rima D. Apple, Vilas Life Cycle Professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Human Ecology and the Women's Studies Program. Good morning.
Good morning, Sandy.
We'll start right out with the first questions that have to do with your childhood, where you were born, where you grew up, where you went to elementary school, high school. Talk about your family, any people who had an influence on you when you were in school.
Okay. I was born in 1944 in New York City. I'm one of those original New Yorkers. But in the early 1950s, we moved to New Jersey. So part of my education was in the New York City public school system. And part of it was in Teaneck, New Jersey, where I graduated high school. And after that, I went to college. It was expected in my family that you went to college. That's just what you did. So I did.
Can you back up a little bit, though? Tell me about your family. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have one older sister who also went to college. And she started at Antioch College and then moved to Brooklyn College. My father had a PhD. My mother had a high school degree, but she was a bookkeeper. And many of my cousins, actually, I think all of my cousins wound up going to college. It's just what we did.
What did your father do?
He was a chemist.
Oh.
So I went to New York University because at the time I was starting college, my mother's health was not good, and I didn't want to be too far away from home. So I stayed home and commuted every day. Another reason I stayed home, to be honest, is because I had a relationship and I didn't want to break up the relationship. So that was another part. As an undergraduate, I was a math major because in high school I got my best grades in mathematics. So I stayed in math. It looked like an easy way until, of course, I hit advanced calculus and then realized I probably wasn't cut out to be a mathematician.
How was your high school? Did you feel that you were prepared for college?
Oh, yes. I'd say probably 80% of my high school was college, was being prepared for college. Mm-hmm. And so everything was geared to that. And I was very well prepared. Teaneck, New Jersey at that time had a very high proportion of college-educated parents who wanted their children to be educated. And it's one of those places where you could actually pass a bond for new school buildings because people believed in schools.
Hmm.
So at that time, I don't know now because I haven't been back for a long time. So I went to NYU and I got my master's degree. And I got my career degree in mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got married. I'm also very traditional in that I got married in June. And I began to work for IBM in Philadelphia because my husband had a job down in South Jersey.
Now, the person you married, was this your high school sweetheart?
Yes.
Okay.
We started dating when I was 13, and then we married when I was 21. He wasn't from Teaneck, though. He was from a different town. We met through Ethical Culture, the Bergen County Society of Ethical Culture. So we went down to the Philadelphia area, where we were for a year. And when my husband finished his bachelor's degree, because he was doing his bachelor's degree at night while he was working full-time and I was working full-time, we decided that he would go to graduate school. And so he applied and was admitted to Columbia, Teachers College Columbia, and I got a job with IBM up in New York City. We spent 4 years in New York City while he completed his graduate program. I worked for IBM.
What did you do for IBM?
I was what they called a systems engineer, which means I programmed machines for customers. At that time, IBM sold machines, and the programming for it came along free. And I was part of the programming.
Oh.
So the first computers I worked on had 4K, and they filled a room. Very different today. And I also worked on punch card machines.
So did you travel a lot in that job then? Or did people come in?
No, all my customers were first in the Philadelphia area and then the New York area. In Philadelphia, I had to drive, but it was all local driving.
Mm-hmm.
And in New York, you just took a subway,
mm-hmm.
wherever you were going, or a taxi.
Mm-hmm.
While I was in New York City, I thought, you know, I want to go to graduate school too. So I started to go to Columbia for library school.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, well, then I took that, and I took several courses, and then I took cataloging. And anybody who's into library school knows exactly what I'm talking about. I decided maybe I wasn't a librarian. I just couldn't think that way. But that was fine. There was no problem. And then my husband got a job out here after he got his degree at the University of Wisconsin. So we moved out here.
Now, what is his degree in?
His degree is in education, sociology of and philosophy of education out of Teachers College. And he's in the curriculum and instruction department and in EPS.
Mm-hmm.
And we came out here and I got a job with the Department of Public Instruction as a computer programmer.
And what year was that?
1970.
Okay.
That was July 1970. And I worked for about a year. And then I was doing some reading. Reading can be really dangerous. And I read Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolution. And I don't know if you're familiar with that book.
No.
Thomas Kuhn is a sociologist, but he looked at the history of science in ways different than people had done before him. And he looked at it as a human enterprise that was influenced by people, not just abstract ideas. And his big thing was the Copernican Revolution and how Copernicus rethought the way the universe was and started a new way of looking at things and established what he called a new paradigm. Well, I got so excited about this idea of people and science, I said, I want to go to graduate school and do this. I like this idea. This is a good idea. At about the same time, I had also gotten pregnant and lost a baby.
Mm.
And so I decided I had to change my life. And so I went to graduate school here in the Department of the History of Science. And that I started that in 1971,
mm-hmm.
first part-time. And one of the first things that I did when I was admitted was I applied for fellowships to help pay for
mm-hmm.
school, right? And at that time I was told that I couldn't get a fellowship because my husband was an assistant professor and he might leave. And so why would they give a fellowship to somebody who wouldn't ever finish the program?
Oh my.
So I said, oh, that's very interesting. Fortunately, however, John Nye, who was the bibliographer of the History of Science in Memorial Library and also the bibliographer for the History of Science Society, worked on a cumulative bibliography, an annual bibliography every year in the history of science, and he needed a project assistant. And so for several years I worked for John as his project assistant, helping him on the CB, which was a fantastic experience because it exposed me to all kinds of areas of history of science that I wouldn't necessarily have touched on before.
Mm-hmm.
But whether it was reading the articles or just sorting the citations, I had a really good sense of the breadth of the field and the excitement of the field was the new things. And John was so excited about what he found. Excuse me. John was so excited about what he found that you had to get excited about what you found because it was just exciting. And so that went on for several years. And then my husband got tenure and I applied for a fellowship. And I was told I couldn't have a fellowship because my husband had tenure and I'd never be leaving, and so I wouldn't be getting a job. So what difference did it make if I finished my degree? So I said, oh, okay. And I continued to work for John, which was very good work for John, but frustrating for not having gotten fellowships, not even being considered for fellowships. Now, at this time, I had been interested in the history of American science, and there was nobody here who really taught a solid course in the history of American science. But just about this time, the university hired somebody who taught the history of American science, I mean, American medicine,
mm.
sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, American science, American medicine, at least it's close. So I took that course and I just got, as they say, bitten by the bug. And history of medicine was the area that I have stayed in for all these many, many years since the early 1970s.
Now, is that faculty person still here?
Yes.
Who is it?
Ron Numbers is the one.
Oh, okay.
Ron Numbers was hired to teach American medicine, and Judy Leavitt was here at that time on a postdoc, and she also taught, she taught the history of American public health. And those two people are the ones who mentored me through my dissertation.
I see.
So, and that was an interesting process too, because I was the first PhD student for both of them, so. I had a very thorough grounding.
I'll bet.
But that is how I got into it, and I got interested in the areas that I've been working in because as part of some of the early research I was doing, I was standing in the stacks of the library, which is what one should do to find a research project, and just going through some old 19th century health manuals, home health care books. And being the 20th century person that I was, I had always assumed that bottle feeding was a 20th century phenomenon, probably somewhere around 1940.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was going through these books from 1880, 1870, 1860, 1850, and they were talking about bottle feeding. I said, this is a very interesting thing. Nobody ever talks about this. Mm-hmm. How could they possibly do that? Being as naive as possible. And that's what got me started, interested in the relationship between mothers and experts, particularly mothers and doctors, starting with who decides what to feed the baby and how the baby is fed. And I've developed that in various ways ever since. But the center of my interest is always the relationship between experts and non-experts.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the way I went about it. So I worked here. I got my master's. And then I got my PhD in 1981, because most of the time it was part-time. In the process, I was raising two children, so things were part-time.
Now, talk about your dissertation a little more.
Okay. With,
you found out about the bottle feeding,
mm-hmm.
and then what? What did you do?
So I decided that I wanted to try and understand why women would bottle feed and what they would bottle feed and why doctors would have suggested it, because it couldn't possibly have been good for them. I'm really a very 20th century person sometimes. And so it involved me studying home medical manuals to find out what women were being told, medical journals to find out what doctors thought about what they were doing and how that changes over time. And also women's magazines, because trying to find women's voices, which is really what I wanted to know, mm-hmm. how the women were reacting and why they were doing what they were doing. Looking historically, about the only place for me in the 19th century was women's magazines. And there were a large number of women's magazines that had extensive letters to the editor columns. How much these letters are true letters and how much might be the editors putting something in or editing something that came in will always be an open question. But it did give me an insight into the way women were thinking about their lives in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And so I studied the history of infant feeding from about 1850 to 1950, because that's when a big switch. And in it, I discovered that women often had very good reasons for doing what they did, surprise, surprise, but they were able to articulate it in a way that I hadn't expected. They articulated their fears, that they saw infants around them dying, mm-hmm. and they wanted their children safe. What would make them safe? Well, modern science appeared to have the answers. Modern science had answers to lots of things in the late 19th century, or appeared to have answers. And so if modern science suggested that you mix milk and sugar and water and cream and make a better, safer product, well, maybe it would be safe to do that. So there were mothers who were thinking quite consciously about mm-hmm. saving their children's lives, and doctors doing the same thing. I mean, doctors got very elaborate plans for mixing formula, but they were aiming to save children's lives. It begins to change, though there is that still only a minority of women are bottle feeding. At the turn of the century, probably about 10 or 15% are bottle feeding. By the 20s, maybe 20 to 30% are bottle feeding. The big change comes, I discovered, with the increased hospitalization of childbirth. Oh. Because you put women in a hospital, there's a fear of epidemics sweeping through hospitals. We're talking about the 1920s, 1930s. Mm-hmm. This is before we have sulfur drugs, before we have antibiotics. So if some kind of disease gets into the hospital, it'll sweep through the hospital. So there's a fear of that. So nurses would take babies immediately upon birth and take them into a sterile nursery. Mm-hmm. And the mothers would be in a separate room. The mothers would see their infants every 3-4 hours, maybe for feeding, then the babies would be taken away. So the mothers would be nervous. They wouldn't have the stimulation to get breastfeeding successfully established. And more women began to turn to bottle feeding because that's what they did in the hospital and it seemed like a good thing to do. So there's a lot of reasons for that, and I was trying to tease that out in my dissertation, which I did work on, and then I extended for my first book, Mothers in Medicine.
So then in 1981, you received your PhD.
Mm-hmm. And I looked around and I said, I'd like a job. What am I going to do? And as it turned out, there was a position at SUNY Stony Brook, State University of New York at Stony Brook, working on an archive of slides of historical medical photographs. So the job was to go and identify historical medical photographs, make slides on them, put them together in a catalog so that other people would be able to use these illustrations for research, for lectures, for what have you. And that job was open and I was interviewed for it and I got the job. So I was living in Madison with my family, and I had a job in Stony Brook out on Long Island, and that was a very interesting.
How old were your children at the time?
8 and 10. So we decided, okay, that this can work. I am fortunate to have an incredibly supportive partner who is not only supportive but also pushes and wants me to be as involved as I want to be. And so, okay, we were going to work it out, and we did. What we did was, my job involved traveling also, as well as going to Stony Brook. So for 2 years, I had a schedule in which I was here 1 week out of the year, 1 week out of the month, sorry, 1 week out of the month, and I was away 1 week out of the month. When I was away, I was either at archives or I was at Stony Brook working on the archive. And when I was here, I was finding pictures here, and I was doing the paperwork that I could do at a distance. So I was maintaining a full-time job, but racking up a lot of frequent flyer miles. That's when we had Republic Airline.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, the Blue Goose and all that kind of stuff. So I did that for 2 years, and then the position ended. It was just a grant. It was a postdoc position. And for several years, I would commute to UW-Milwaukee, and I taught in their pre-med program, a history of medicine course. And then in 1989, the History of Science Society said that the University of Wisconsin-Madison would be the editorial home for ISIS, which is the International Journal for the History of Science and the History of Science Society. And when that moved here, I became the assistant editor and then the associate editor of that journal. So I had a position here while I was living here, actually in the same place. It was very nice. And then towards the end of the 1980s, beginning around 1990s, it was clear that I wanted more of a position, and we didn't know exactly what we wanted to do, and there were a number of places that were asking us to apply for positions where we could both have academic positions. And in 1992, very early 1992, late 1991, we had offers both of us had offers from UCLA and from Columbia. And so we sat down and we tried to figure out what we were going to do. And there were some people on campus here who wanted to keep us here. And we were very above board. We said, you know, if you can come up with an offer, we would like to stay, but we both need academic positions.
Mm-hmm. Were you you were still doing the editing for ISIS,
yes.
But you really wanted something else.
I wanted an academic.
Yep.
Yeah, I wanted
a
teaching
right.
position.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Because I was doing my own research while I was doing my editorial work, but it really wasn't the comfortable way I wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm.
Though I loved doing editorial work, I loved seeing new papers come in and new interest areas and what people were dealing with. It was fascinating for that aspect. So at that time, the dean of the School of Education was Henry Trueba, and Henry was very interested in keeping us here. And he helped us. He tried to work around finding a position for me, which he knew would help keep us here,
mm-hmm.
if I had a position. And they tried various things. At that point, I was associated with Women's Studies as an affiliate of Women's Studies. And Women's Studies was very willing, but they don't have tenure track positions, or they didn't at that point. So they were willing to give me a 25 or 50% appointment, but if I wanted a tenure track appointment, I needed a tenure home
mm-hmm.
somewhere else. And so they looked, and History of Science decided that, no, they didn't want me. They looked at my book, and they knew what I could do, and it just wasn't good enough. So they didn't want me. But then the School of Human Ecology, which at that point was called the School of Family Resources and Consumer Sciences, was interested in me because of the kind of work I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to back up a little bit because it gets kind of
convoluted.
As I mentioned, my early work was on the history of infant feeding, and I'm interested in the relationship between mothers and physicians and lay people and experts in general.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I wanted to write a book about what's called the history of scientific motherhood. Scientific motherhood is the 19th century concept that women need science and medicine to raise their children healthfully and appropriately. And it becomes transformed in the 20th century to women need to follow the directions of experts. They have to listen to what their doctors tell them, because their doctors know and women don't know. It does get changed in the late 20th century. But I was going to do a history of scientific motherhood. And I realized infant feeding was too narrow a topic.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, okay, I have to understand better contemporary science and how that influenced mothers in all these different periods.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the areas I could look at would be nutrition. And as we know, vitamins were discovered in the early 20th century. So wouldn't it be interesting to see, you know, before they had vitamins, and then when they started to discover vitamins, what kind of information were women given, and how did they respond to that information? But then I discovered that nobody had done the history of vitamins that I could write the mother's experiences against.
Hmm.
So I didn't even have a timeline, except for a few of the discoveries, of course, but I didn't really have a timeline for when products were available, when people started learning about vitamins, when it went into nutrition education. So I wound up writing my next single-authored book, which was Vitamania. Vitamania has to do with the relationship between the public and experts on if you should take vitamins, what kind of vitamins you should take, under what circumstances you should take vitamins. Vitamins are ridiculous to take, don't ever take them, they're really stupid, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, I was really involved with the history of consumerism and the history of consumer movements.
Mm-hmm.
So the School of Family Resources and Consumer Sciences said, well, you know, you could teach a history of consumerism or history of consumer movements for us, and that would really fit. I said, well, it's not exactly my area, but I certainly could move into that area, because in reality, if you think about it, the history of consumerism has to do with the history of consumer protection, which has to do with science and society. because it's technology and biology and physics, and it's how we put science into society and then react to it. So I said, okay, but I also want to teach history and motherhood. That's my area. And so they hired me to teach the history of consumer movements and the history of motherhood. And I had an affiliate position with Women's Studies. And the school has now changed its name to the School of Human Ecology, but it's the same mm-hmm. school and the same basic
courses. And this was a tenure-track position.
This was a tenure-track position. Mm-hmm. I got the letter in late 1991. I started in 1992. I immediately went up for tenure because I was hired under those circumstances. And so I got tenure in 1992. So I was an associate professor.
So this is not a normal pathway to... receiving tenure. Did you compete for this position, or they just really created this position for you?
No, they created the position for me. They wanted me that much. They created the position for me. And Michael and I were willing to compromise and the positions in L.A. and New York were different, mm-hmm. but it was important enough for us to stay because this was a good place for our family. And if it was a place where we could both have jobs,
sure.
That was fine. Mm-hmm. I also did hear afterwards, because you mentioned this is not a usual mm-hmm. trajectory, that when I went up before divisional committee for tenure, there were some women on the divisional committee who had to point out that this was not a usual tenure, but I had done everything that you needed to do. I hadn't done as much teaching, because I had just had some teaching at UW-Milwaukee, mm-hmm. but I had all the publications and all the service, and I understand they had to explain that to the divisional committee, and I'm very grateful that they did, because it made life much easier.
What was the reputation of that department when you started?
The reputation of the school.
The school.
The reputation of the school was that there were some very good programs going on, but it was not the strongest school in the university, but that the kinds of courses that we were getting were the kinds of courses that were preparing people for the jobs that were available. Mm-hmm. So it was not seen as a liberal arts school so much as a professional school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's what I knew I was going into that when mm-hmm. I went into it. Didn't quite understand how much, but I knew that. And I was teaching students who were not interested in history and didn't always know why they were sitting in the classes. Mm. But then to see some of them get very excited about the possibilities of history really helped. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a very good thing.
And talk a little bit about the Women's Studies program at that time. Mm. What were you teaching there?
I didn't actually teach a course in the Women's Studies program. Women's Studies students took my History of Motherhood course.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So for complicated administrative reasons, I didn't put it in Women's Studies.
Mm-hmm.
But I was on the, and I am on the Executive Committee of Women's Studies, and I've worked very closely with them. It has been one of the supportive places on campus to go where you don't have to explain why you're doing what you do. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing as going to a conference on women's history as opposed to going to a conference on history of science. You don't have to explain why you're doing what you're doing. You just explain what you're doing, mm-hmm. which is very nice. And Women's Studies was always there, was supportive and ready for me when I had any problems. And I'm very appreciative of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's changed over the years. It's become more like an academic program, but it still has that underpinning of mentoring
mm-hmm.
that is so important. So let me see, where shall we go from
here? So you in 1992, you received tenure.
I received tenure in 1992, mm-hmm. and actually it was a part-time position. It was only a 50% position, but that was okay because it was a faculty position with tenure here, mm-hmm. so I felt comfortable mm-hmm. about that. But then in 1996, the school decided that they needed a new department. They needed a department called Interdisciplinary Studies in Human Ecology, a department for the students who didn't necessarily want to go into child and family studies or consumer science or retailing or interior design, but who wanted to have a sense of families and communities and work perhaps in human service kinds of organizations mm-hmm. and groups like that, nonprofits. And so they developed this, or began to develop this interdisciplinary program. And the dean of the school at that time was Hamilton McCubbin, and he went to the provost, and he said, you know, we really want this program, and if you give us another 50% for Rima, then she can be in the program. So I did another slight career twist, and on top of teaching the history of consumer movements and the history of motherhood, I began to teach the history of home economics, which was the forerunner of human ecology, mm-hmm. and service learning. So that's a number of the career switches I've made, which I think is not unusual for women who are trying to fit in somehow. Mm-hmm. And I don't begrudge them. They were very interesting to me. But it did mean that I had to make some mental shifts that I might not have made before. Mm-hmm. And despite my teaching making those shifts, my research has always remained centered on women and doctors and laity and experts and the role of science in society.
Universities that have the equivalent of a school of human ecology, or how are those the topics from our school covered in other universities?
Well, human ecology grows out of the home economics movement of the late 19th and early 20th century. Most land-grant colleges had schools of home economics or departments of home economics. They do today still have the remnants of it. For instance, at Cornell, it's called the College of Human Ecology, and they have many of the same programs. But they've all modified over the years to reflect the communities that they're in. So for instance, at Cornell, one of the large schools is the, I don't actually remember what they call it, but it has to do with hotel management.
Oh.
And they deal with how you run hotels and how you run recreation areas, mm-hmm. Because that is very big in that area. And they also have the equivalent of family studies and the equivalent of consumer economics. In various other schools, they're now configured somewhat differently. They have some different names. They're sometimes family resources and consumer sciences, some form of human ecology. Some of them are still called home economics. And they generally tend to be land-grant universities mm-hmm. of various kinds.
Are the students predominantly women?
Depends on the program. It depends on the program.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, consumer economics programs, which are preparing people to go out into the retail field or go out into personal finance fields, often have a heavy student body weighted towards men,
mm-hmm.
not women, though in this school, actually, we have more women than men. Interior decorating tends to be heavily women. Cornell, the hotel program is men. So it depends mm-hmm. on the various programs.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer strictly a women's school. It's definitely not that.
Mm-hmm.
But it still has a heavy student body of women.
How about faculty? Are they more?
Same with faculty. Faculty mm-hmm. tends to be weighted towards women, but there are more and more men that are being hired.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends the areas again. Historically, that started to change in the 1960s and the 1970s. Before that, the faculties were almost totally women and the student bodies were almost totally women. And it starts to change in the 60s and the 70s because there's an influx of federal money for returning GIs, male
oh.
GIs, to go into areas like child psychology, which are in family studies.
Mm-hmm.
And so you start seeing more men going into those areas.
That's interesting.
So it is very interesting.
Yeah.
There's an interesting article written on there, the title of which is, "And Then the Men Came In." I wish it was my article, but it's not. It's someone else's article. Okay, looking at your list of questions.
Well, could you talk about your teaching experience? Because you said that's the one thing you hadn't done a lot of when you went into this faculty position. Did you immediately enjoy it?
No.
Okay.
No, I did not immediately enjoy it. I went through, though I was older than most starting teachers, I went through the usual discomfort of standing up in front of a group and am I going to be wrong and are they going to see through me and I don't really know everything and suppose they ask me a question I can't answer and I over-prepared for everything. I did all those things, stereotypical things that I thought I was past, but I clearly wasn't past it. But I did start to enjoy it after a while because I like to tell stories. And history is made up of people. Mm-hmm. And once I can get the class to understand that and to be interested in people and what people did and how people reacted, then it's really a great deal of fun. And they enjoy it too, particularly this semester. I've had some students that really got into the idea of people matter and this is what people did. And maybe they'll go out and they can't change the world. Maybe they can change the world, mm-hmm. but at least they're starting to think of ways that they can interact with the world.
Have you had students that are on their way to changing the world?
I don't know yet.
Okay. Well, yeah, it hasn't been that many years.
There hasn't been that many
years.
I do know some that are thinking about it and that are going into areas like that, but they haven't quite had the effect yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The thing about my teaching is that I really don't tend to have very many graduate students because we've only, in the School of Human Ecology, we've really only been developing the PhD program over the last several years.
Hmm.
We've had master's programs. But the students in our schools are not going to get degrees in history. It doesn't make any sense for them to get a degree in history. So I'm on committees, but I don't have many of my very own students.
Mm-hmm.
My students tend to come from other departments and I work with them. So, for instance, I had a student who was a master's student in history of science who became my project assistant while I was working on the centennial for the School of Human Ecology.
Mm-hmm.
And we got very close and she was really developing as a historian. And that kind of a relationship is what makes teaching so important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Rima, when the school changed its name to School of Human Ecology, did the culture change? And could you talk about what the culture of the department is now?
I can't say that the culture changed in connection with the name change. Over the last 15 years or so, there has been a change in the school, in the culture of the school, and I think a lot of it has to do with the need for status, the recognition for what we do,
mm-hmm.
and the need for funds. And as everyone in academia is now scrambling for funds, mm-hmm. so are we. And it's making it more and more difficult for us to do those things that don't have some kind of monetary reward. It's very, you know, you try and construct courses that are going to interest students who are going to go out into the work world, and then you hope maybe you can get some funding to help you with some TAs, or you want some PAs, or you need equipment. And with budgetary crunches, a lot of people, more and more people, are scrambling for
mm-hmm.
the funds.
Mm-hmm.
And that scrambling changes the atmosphere of a school.
Mm-hmm.
You wind up becoming more self-interested and less involved with things that don't have that payoff that you need.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has been affecting the school. The name change in some ways is indicative of that, in that many people feel that the name the School of Human Ecology sounds better than the School of Family Resources and Consumer Sciences.
Mm.
And since the abbreviation, Family Resources Consumer Science, FRCS, used to be shortened to FRACIS,
that's right.
People prefer the School of Human Ecology.
I see.
I do see, even just in the 15 years that I've been, that there is a change in the tenure of the place. And I think that's true across the whole campus. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's just in one school. Everybody's feeling that crunch, and it's affecting us all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talk about your publications. I know you've mentioned some of your books. Is that one of the most difficult things to do in terms of your time? But is it also, is it one of the things you enjoy the most? Or?
You've said it perfectly.
Okay.
Yes, that's
Talk
right.
Talk about it then.
I would say that writing is enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Writing is necessary. It's very difficult to be teaching full-time and writing or doing research. And one of the most difficult things is finding the time to do that. And I have been fortunate that I've been able to get grants that have given me the time off. I've had NSF, I've had NIH, I've had some graduate school grants. And that has helped me take the time off because my writing is very, very important to me. I think I have things to say. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to say it in a way that people can hear it. I was very grateful that several weeks ago, the Wisconsin State Journal called me up and asked me to write an op-ed piece for Motherhood, on Motherhood for Mother's Day. And I was very pleased about that because mm-hmm. I want to get the word out. I'm not a touchy-feely person, but I think that people don't recognize what mothers do. For that matter, they don't recognize what fathers do, but I'm working on the mothers first.
Right.
And so it's important for me to be able to make those statements and get out. And that is not just on this university campus. It's important for me to get to larger audiences as well. And my publications are one of the ways that I do that. Mm-hmm. Lecturing is another way, and I really enjoy lecturing too, going out and talking to new people and getting new ideas, particularly internationally. The two books that have really made a difference have been Vitamania, partly because of the title.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't make the word up. I actually, it is a historical word, Vitamania. The AMA invented it for the frenzy over vitamins. But people want to know about vitamins. And of course, the first question always is, do you take vitamins? But when we get past that, then, you know, we have these marvelous conversations. And how do you judge, how do you evaluate, what does it mean when you read this science, what does it mean when you read this advertisement, how do you make decisions, and how people have done that over time and then justified what they've done and fought for their decisions. It's very important for us to understand because we're living in a world now where so much of our information is supposedly science-based, and we read these headlines about science now tells us, science now tells mm-hmm. us. And we need to have a historical understanding of where that comes from and what we can do with it. And so I really enjoy being able to go out and talk about vitamins. Everybody has an opinion about vitamins. And then everybody has an opinion about doctors. So when I talk about mothers and doctors, I can get some giggles when I go back and I talk about some of the older stuff. But people are starting to think about, yes, now, how do our relationships work, and do we just take what the doctor says, or what do we do? And mm-hmm. that's very important to me.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said there were two books. What was the other one? You said that...
The Perfect Motherhood.
Okay.
Which is, I think, just out now, but I don't have a copy in my hand yet.
Oh.
They're mailing it to me.
But and what is that about?
It's a history of scientific motherhood. I finally
oh,
got
that's
back
the,
to
oh,
it.
Oh, that's the one. Okay, I see.
I finally did it.
Great.
Yeah.
Now... In your lecturing, international lecturing,
yeah.
talk about some of the places you've been and the people that you've had contact with.
Well, I've done a variety of lecturing. Sometimes it's at conferences,
mm-hmm.
and conferences usually mean it's with other academics.
Mm-hmm.
And the best ones in that case are often the smaller conferences where you really get a chance to just talk about and focus on and kind of pull apart arguments. And mm-hmm. and the international aspect is so important because on the one hand, we know the U.S. is not the rest of the world. Usually we know that. Not always. Usually we know that. But then it's another thing to hear it. And we are really very strange in some of our, the way we have our medical system set up and the way we handle over-the-counter drugs are very different from a lot of other countries. Mm-hmm. So there are the academic conferences, but I really enjoy getting to see non-historians and getting to talk to non-historians. So when I was in New Zealand, one of the times I was in New Zealand, I spoke to academic audiences, I spoke to undergraduate students, but then one of the best lectures was when I spoke to what are called the Plunkett nurses. The Plunkett nurses are not really, they're not RNs, but you can think of them as kind of visiting nurses. They go around and help new mothers, and they're part of the Plunkett Society. And so talking to them about doctors and mothers and nurses and getting the New Zealand aspect, it's just a thrilling thing. And they're so interested in what you have to say because they know, of course, New Zealand's a small country, they know that they're not like the rest of the world, and so they want to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that. And I think I give them something too. Mm-hmm.
How did you make that connection with them? You knew about them? And
oh, well, I was busy. We were living in New Zealand for a couple of months.
Oh, okay.
And yes, I knew about the Plunkett.
Uh-huh.
That's one of the things that the New Zealand medical system is known for, is the Plunkett nurses system.
I see.
It started in 1913, I think, mm-hmm. and it's still going strong.
Mm-hmm.
Plunkett nurses visit virtually every newborn baby in New Zealand, and they have things that are called Plunkett books that the nurses jot down all the vital statistics every time she visits. They're all she's,
mm-hmm.
every time she visits. And there are families that save those and have like 3 and 4 generations of Plunkett books.
Oh my.
It's just a whole different view of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's, and that's, I think with this Perfect Motherhood, it's gonna be even more of that because people have opinions mm-hmm. about this, and whether you're a mother or a father or a child or a grandparent, you relate to it.
Sure, sure. You mentioned briefly about your research funding. Could you talk a little bit more about that? Because I assume that's a quite a bit of a time-consuming project too, of just writing the grants and getting the funds to do what you want to do.
Writing the grants, and it's getting more and more difficult because there's less and less grant money for things like this. I have tried and I have been successful for each one of my projects to get at least one major grant that was giving me time off and giving me money for research assistance, which is very important.
Mm-hmm.
The primary areas for the kind of research that I do is actually the federal government. The National Institutes of Health have what are called publication grants through the National Library of Medicine. And the National Science Foundation has grants for history. It goes under social science and humanities.
Mm-hmm.
But they are highly, highly competitive. I've been sitting on the NIH study panel for the last couple of years doing the selections for the grant proposals, and we are not granting even 10% because we just don't have the money. And now, every grant proposal that comes by is not good. Mm-hmm. Some of them are really mm-hmm. not good, but I would say that if the money was available, we could easily find 3 times more to fund.
Mm-hmm.
So people are trying to find other ways. Their sabbaticals are always possible if you have a school mm-hmm. that has a sabbatical, and I did have a sabbatical a couple of years ago, which was very good. But then you can take a cut in pay if you take the whole year off, because for a sabbatical at the university here, if you take one semester, you get 100%, but if you take 2 semesters, you get 60% or 65%. So people then have to try and match up the money.
Sure.
And there are some organizations. It takes a lot of time not only to do the grant proposals, but to identify the granting agencies. And for that, it's very important that you have a network. And what I mean by that is that For instance, one of the grants that I got is called ACOG, which is the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And I wouldn't have known about that if it wasn't that I had a network of people who do the history of medicine and who've been applying, and they say, oh, well, did you think about this one?
Mm-hmm.
And then I can say to somebody else, well, did you think about that one? It's not that they're hidden. Mm-hmm. It's that they're just hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
And to figure out if you fit in them and what you can do for them. So we do a lot of that. And we're doing a lot of mentoring. And by that, by we, I mean within my professional organizations, particularly the History of Science Society and the American Association for the History of Medicine. We have separate women's groups that have breakfasts and sometimes have other meetings. And we are mentoring the younger scholars
mm-hmm.
in these kinds of areas, because if somebody doesn't help you, you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they're graduate students, they're not always getting the help from their home department. So,
sure.
We've now established some formal mentoring to help them outside, and that's been very important. That's why I enjoy going to these national meetings, because you feel like it's a community
mm-hmm.
and you're assisting other people.
Mm-hmm. Are there other organizations that you belong to that you're active in?
Yeah, the other organization right now, over the years I've been active in different ones depending on where my research has been going, and the other one that I'm becoming much more active in right now is the American Association for the History of Nursing, because I'm now going back and focusing more particularly on nurses and what nurses were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a group I'm reestablishing connections with.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions here is, what are the most significant developments in your field of study? Well, your field of study is quite broad, but in the area, well, talk about any of it that you want to talk about.
Well, I think in terms of history of science, history of medicine, and history of nursing, the most significant developments in the last 20, 25 years have been the recognition of the importance of everyone. And what I mean is, you know, if you go back about 30 years and you look at history of medicine, people are reading Osler, Nutting, you know, the big names, right? Many mm-hmm. of them are big men, some of them are women. And now in the history of medicine, we're thinking about paraprofessionals, we're thinking about patients, we're thinking about families. We're thinking about medicine within a culture, medicine within a society, not just the elites of the profession.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true of all of these areas that I work in, that there's a recognition of the importance of what has been called history from the bottom up. And it's not just a recognition, it's a true appreciation. And people are really involved with understanding it and seeing that if we want to use history and understand history, we can't just cream off the top. We have to have the depth.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pleased to be a part of that. I think some of that I have led in, and some of that I have been following in. And I think that's the way we work.
Talk about the ones that you've led in, the ones that you think have had the most influence on what's happening in your field.
Well, I think the idea of scientific motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
It is a term that sometimes appeared in the 19th century literature, but I'm the one that's brought it into the historiography of the 20th and 21st century, and other people are using that idea now and building on it, the idea of women needing science, should use science, but how do you use it so that you don't just become passive? What does it mean? How do you balance it? And tracing women's conflicts over that
mm-hmm.
and women's struggles over that. I think that to some extent I was leading the way, certainly in terms of calling it scientific motherhood and actually defining it.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, and people have followed up on it.
Mm-hmm. You've been involved in committees and
mm.
faculty governance and areas like that probably right from the beginning of
before the beginning
before the beginning of your academic appointment. Could you talk about some of the roles that you've played on campus outside of this school?
Sure. As I mentioned earlier, women's studies has been very important. And even before I had a tenure track position here, when I was the editor and I had an academic staff position, being able to be in women's studies and see how governance works and understand the university from that perspective really helped. As you probably know, I've been on a number of library committees. Mm-hmm. I happen to like being on library committees. I've been on archives committees. I like being on archives committees. Because I think in those committees, I can see that decisions that we make have some kind of impact, that we can actually do something. The other committee that I most enjoy being on is actually a school committee, a school of human ecology committee, and that's the Student Academic Affairs Committee. And the reason I enjoy that is not because we get the appeals from being, you know, bounced out of school, but because we decide the scholarships.
Oh.
And reading the scholarship applications and seeing what the students do and being able to actually give money to somebody to help them, it's so good. That's a committee that I really, that's an immediate gratification, you know I've done this is good, kind of a thing. So that's a committee that I enjoy. But it's, I guess outside of my school, it's mostly been, I was on the graduate studies committee once, and then faculty senate.
Mm-hmm.
And the TAPA.
How did you like the faculty senate?
Do you really want me to answer that?
I do, not if you don't want to answer it.
Faculty senate is a lot of talking and doesn't get a heck of a lot done. And which is a shame. I mean, it should be a more effective group, but it's not.
Yeah. Did anything controversial come up while you were a senator?
Oh, I'm sure. But it was a while ago.
Managed to put it out of your mind.
Because it had there were no results. Yeah. I mean, nothing happened, so, yeah.
Could I ask, if you just go back, what is the source of the scholarships that you're able to give out from the school?
The school has a large number of endowments that have been growing over the years. They go back, to the 1930s, 1940s, mm-hmm. and on up, and people are still endowing scholarships. So we give out, I think it was something over 100. I mean, they're not huge.
Yeah.
They're like $2,000.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a significant chunk for somebody who needs the money. Mm-hmm. So, but they're based on endowments that go back a long time.
Would you discuss the climate for women here? And does it help or hinder the participation and advancement of women on campus?
I think that the climate for women hasn't changed as much as we had hoped it would. And some of the committees that I've been on in the last 15 years have been equity committees. Mm. And every equity committee, you wind up having these fights over, well, how do you really measure things and how do we know? And we're really good people, so we couldn't possibly be having any problems. And I think that people still have not been able to face up to the fact that women are not the same as men, are not the same as women. And we haven't figured out how to help people. Let me give you just one example. We now have maternity leave, which is really good. Mm-hmm. You can take the time off after you have a child or after you adopt, and that's really great. But it's not just women who are taking it. It's men who are taking it. Well, that's fine. That's, But the men who are taking it aren't staying home and taking care of the child.
Really?
The men who are taking it are doing their writing. So we haven't, and people know that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the climate is still that kind of tension.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the sciences in particular, I can't answer because I'm not in the physical or biological sciences. But it seems to me that in my school I don't have any problems, and I have to say that quite proudly and quite gratefully. Mm-hmm. When I have had, for instance, several years ago I had ovarian cancer, and my school was incredibly supportive. And they're that supportive with men, when men have had problems too, so, mm-hmm. you know, that's fine. But there's still something when it comes down to workload, when it comes down to salaries, when it comes down to understanding who does what kind of work. I can't tell you the number of people who've asked me, well, why are you doing the history of mothers? Why aren't you doing fathers? So there's always that in the background. So we haven't gotten to nirvana yet.
Now, these are academic people that
yes.
are asking you that question?
Yes, academic oh. people. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Are there opportunities for women to network on this campus, or formal opportunities, or is it more of an informal process?
Well, there is the women's mentoring program, and I think it was stronger earlier, and I probably shouldn't be too definitive about that because I have not been that involved for the last couple of years. I've been very busy with other things. On the days they have their lunches is when I teach, so I haven't been able to get there. That's just a problem that'll change because I'm not teaching next semester. I think there are those opportunities, but I think that the people who need them the most, the assistant professors, are still not comfortable enough with it. Mm. And I say that because I've known several assistant professors who've been part of the mentoring process. And as far as I can see, many of them don't utilize it. Now, I don't want to blame them. I think there's something about the program or something about our atmosphere that doesn't suggest to them the openness that we think we're giving them. And I'm not quite sure what we can do about it. Mm-hmm. But it's all in place. It just doesn't always seem to be clicking. And it could be personalities. It could be a whole slew of other things that I think we have to look into.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You are the Vilas Life Cycle Professor.
Mm-hmm.
Would you talk about that? What is that, the Vilas Life Cycle Professor?
Vilas Life Cycle Professor is a special program that was set up a couple of years ago for people who have significant life changes that have in some way affected their scholarship, slowed down their scholarship. Mm. So it could be a divorce. It could be fighting alcoholism. So the Vilas Life Cycle Professorship was set up so that people who had these problems could apply for funding to help them get back on their research track. So it doesn't release you from teaching, but it does provide money for things like project assistance and equipment and various resources that you might need.
Mm-hmm.
I needed a laptop computer. I have a research assistant who is absolutely splendiferous. Resources like I have a lot of photographs I need to get copied and that kind of a thing, mm-hmm. and photocopying that. So it's a special program.
Mm-hmm.
I've been telling people about it. Not everybody talks about it because there are people who have gotten this for reasons that they would prefer not to publicize.
I see.
But in my situation, I mean, I don't care. Who knows that I had ovarian cancer?
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of the people who survived, so
right.
better you should know it. You mm-hmm. can survive. And I'm very grateful for the university for setting up the program because it really did get me back on track. I was really set back probably 9 months.
Oh, my.
And this really got me back on track.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are there other awards, honors that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I've gotten a number of awards, I'm pleased to say.
Mm-hmm.
Often in terms of fellowships,
mm-hmm.
which is good.
Yeah.
So next semester I'm going to be the Women's Studies Feminist Fellow, which means I'm released from teaching, so I'll be able to do my research and writing.
Very
so
good.
All the work that the project assistant has developed for me this year, I'm actually going to have time to write up as well as look at.
Now, will this be a book or will this be articles or don't you know
I'm
yet?
I'm starting off with articles. It will eventually be a book, but I'm not sure exactly the direction of the book yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fantastic collection that I have found in the State Historical Society from the 1930s and 1940s of narrative reports that public health nurses wrote up and sent back, talking about their lives and the people they met and what happened in the communities. So there are about five different ways I can go depending on how everything falls into place.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll probably eventually be a book.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm proud of that.
Yeah.
Because that means my colleagues here respect what I'm doing.
Sure.
And that makes me feel good. And Vitamania won an award from the American Institute for the History of Pharmacy, which I'm proud of because
mm-hmm.
it means I'm recognized by people outside of that. I think those are the life cycle.
Right.
The wireless life cycle I'm proud of. So generally, I've gotten awards that recognize my scholarship,
mm-hmm.
which gives me a great deal of satisfaction because you don't get that in the classroom and you don't get that in committee meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Yet that's what we spend our time on.
Right.
So I'm very pleased to have it, and I'm very pleased to be able to help other people along the way to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, the final two questions have to do with life after work. If you would describe your family and how you've been able to balance work and family, you've had some interesting twists in that area over
yes.
the years. And what do you do for fun and relaxation when you're not working?
When I'm not working, well, as a true academic, I probably work about 80 hours a week. It's what you do, right?
Uh-huh.
You can never turn off your mind, though you can try and sleep, even if you can't turn off your mind. Right now, it's easier to balance my work and family because my children are grown and out of the house.
Where are they? And who are they?
Who are they? Okay. My oldest, Paul, is 34, and he works outside of Chicago. He's a single father with a 13-year-old daughter. And our youngest is 32. Peter is a teacher in Lake Geneva who lives in Edgerton and whose wife goes to school at Edgewood for
oh.
nursing. So we, and they have a son, Alex, who's in daycare.
So you're a grandmother?
Grandmother twice over.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit easier because you don't have to worry about getting home to make the supper and what have you. I'm very fortunate. I mentioned this before, and I don't mean to sound like some kind of, I know, Cinderella or something, but my husband and I have a very good relationship, and we work things off. So, for instance, I cooked for 25 years. I don't like cooking. I'm bored with cooking. He comes home from work, and he's agitated, and cooking relaxes him. So he cooks, you know, fine, okay.
Mm-hmm.
No, he doesn't like doing the bills. I do the bills. So we basically work things out without any big problems, and we're both aware of the pressures that we're under,
mm-hmm.
so that it's relatively easy for us to balance things out depending on how things are going. I know I've just romanticized everything, and nobody can believe how idealized it is, but it really is a very good, firm relationship, and we were just in Greece on a trip, and it was very interesting because the graduate students kept coming up to me and remarking on my relationship with my husband. I mean, it's not something that you really think of, but they say, where can we find somebody like him? It's really kind of strange.
Uh-huh.
I didn't think in Greece. So the balancing is we just try and tell each other when to stop and like, okay, you've done enough email, it's time to get off. Let's take a walk. We
mm-hmm.
walk a lot. I find walking very relaxing. My husband has arthritis and walking is very good for him. So he walks about 4 miles a day, and I walk about 6 to 8 if I can.
6 to 8 miles a day?
Yeah.
Oh,
I really try and do it.
Do you live near campus?
Yeah.
So you can walk back and forth? Oh, that's
that helps.
Nice.
That helps.
Yeah.
It's about a 20-minute walk, so that's, you know, that's almost 2 miles right
there.
Sure. And that's, we do a lot of that, and we do a lot of reading. I've discovered Sudoku.
Oh.
It's really addictive. Have you done it?
I can't, I've tried.
Boy, it gets addictive.
That's
it's incredible.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing is travel.
Yeah.
We really like to travel. And one of the joys of being an academic and one of the benefits of being an academic is that you get to travel. There are conferences, there are lectures, there are all kinds of reasons to travel. And so we try and take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. Where are the places that you've been that you would love to go back?
I'd love to go back to Australia. I love Australia, particularly the Great Barrier Reef.
Hmm.
We just had a marvelous week and a half in Greece, and I look forward to going back there sometime because it was really fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Where else? Australia, Greece, Japan. Japan was very good. But there are a lot of places we haven't been that we still want to go. So I've never been to Italy. I've never been to Spain. I'd like to go back to Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, chances are if I've been there, I want to go back there.
Sure. I understand.
So that's basically what we do. We walk and we travel and we read and...
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a great life.
Yeah. Enjoy our kids.
Yeah. That's the end of our questions, but... There's still time if there's something that we've missed that you would like to make sure gets on the tape.
Hmm. Well, I think, I don't know who's going to use this tape for what, so it's hard to figure out what one needs to say. But I think that basically I would stress the importance of support networks and that the reason I've been able to do what I've been able to do, which has been not a direct route, but has been a productive route, is because I've had people around me, starting with my husband, going through my children, all that time I was commuting, you know, they were cleaning the house and running the washing machine, and colleagues, both on campus here and nationally and internationally, who have given the support and the help and the encouragement and to allow me to do what I can do and to allow me to help others to do what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's very important. As I always tell my students, doing history, doing anything, is not a solitary act. You have a lot of people around you. You're working off of a lot of people's work, but you also need to have the atmosphere and the support in order to go and do it. And I've been very fortunate to have that for a good part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope everybody else can find it. But that sounds too Pollyanna-ish, so I'll just say work for it.
Very good. Great way to end. Thank you very much.
Thank you.